So we're going to finish with the series of investigators of the group with Rima Rosen. She joined the group in 1987. She's been the director of the group throughout the 2000s, and her presentations, the interactions between genes and greens, folate, and common disorders.
So we've been interested in genetic and nutritional disturbances in folate metabolism for many years. And, of course, the classic folate responsive disorder is neural tube defects. These are relatively common birth defects, and they have both a genetic and environmental component. It's been quite clear for many years, and you heard about Clark Fraser's work, that low dietary folate certainly contributes to increased risk for NTDs. But it was also becoming evident that there may be some metabolic or genetic disturbances in women that also predispose them to this increased risk for neural tube defects. And in fact, it was the hyperhomocysteinemia in the mothers of NTD children that suggested a link between folate and homocysteine metabolism. So I'm not going to go through this entire pathway, but we've been working for quite some time now on MTHFR, and the reason MTHFR made sense in terms of neural tube defects was because it synthesized the primary circulatory form of folate, and this particular folate derivative is necessary for conversion of homocysteine to methionine. And so the hyperhomocysteinemia and the folate responsiveness in neural tube defects made sense. But at the time that we started to work on MTHFR, it had only been really reported to be deficient in this obscure disorder called homocystinuria. And David had collected some patients with defects in MTHFR and homocystinuria, so we set out to clone MTHFR for that reason. We didn't really have any idea at the time that it would be involved in so many different complex traits. However, there was one paper by a group that suggested there was an unstable or thermal label form of MTHFR which might be involved in cardiovascular disease. So we were hopeful but certainly not certain that we would find anything to do with complex traits, but given the fact that we could at least look at homocystinuria, we embarked on the cloning of MTHFR, which we did achieve in the mid-90s, and then we started to identify mutations in this gene, mostly in patients with homocystinuria. And most of the mutations that you see in this slide are really fairly classic types of mutations, and all but two of these mutations are seen in patients with homocystinuria, and I really won't talk about that today, because what was more interesting to us and to a lot of people was the fact that there was this other mutation that we identified, a base pair 677, that converted an alanine to a valine, and there was another polymorphism at the C-terminal end, which has not been as well characterized, and I'm not going to have time to talk about that. So this transition into birth defects, or potentially into birth defects and multifactorial disorders, was a difficult one for us. I mean, obviously, I had trained with Charles, and we had collaborated on PKU, and so I was fairly comfortable working on inborn errors of metabolism. But birth defects and complex traits was more difficult because here we were looking at risk factors. So your mice were not guaranteed to have neural tube defects or heart disease or anything else. They might have a quantitative increase in risk, you know, twofold or threefold or whatever, but it was no guarantee. And so you'd have to look through large numbers of animals and large number of conditions and then do the statistical analyses to, in fact, show that this gene might be involved in complex traits. So unfortunately, I did not have the opportunity to work with Clark when he was working on, you know, heart defects and cleft palate. But we were certainly cognizant of the principles that he had developed, and it was my privilege to actually collaborate with him on one paper. This is the last paper that I show you here, where we looked at gender differences in terms of this particular variant, and we did find some gender differences. I don't know if anyone's ever repeated that, but nonetheless, to me, it was an opportunity to work with Clark, and I didn't need any other reason to do the paper, frankly. But this deficiency in MTHFR that we identified, this polymorphism, did reduce enzyme activity. It was associated with a thermolabile enzyme, and we showed that it increased homocysteine levels. And at the time, homocysteine was being considered a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, so not only were we potentially involved in neural tube defects, we also had potential to study cardiovascular disease related to this pathway. And so this just shows you how common this particular variant is. This is the homozygosity frequency. So 10 to 15% of North Americans are homozygous for this particular variant. Even higher frequencies in Hispanic populations, lower frequencies in blacks and native populations. But nonetheless, this is not a trivial polymorphism, and it is population specific in terms of its frequency. And just to show that there was, in fact, an increase in homocysteine levels with this variant, we looked at a control group of patients from Framingham, and we could see, in fact, that individuals with this homozygous mutant genotype did have increased homocysteine. But what was quite interesting was the fact that there appeared to be an interaction with folate status. In other words, when we subdivided this group into those with low folate and those with high folate, we could see that those with high folate had actually no effect of this, were not responsive to the effect of this particular genotype. It was only if you were low folate. So there was this potential interaction between genes and nutrients, which is really the hallmark of multifactorial disorders. And we were able to show that this was due to the fact that this particularly unstable enzyme could, in fact, be stabilized by folate. So if you take lymphocytes from individuals with the various genotypes, you can see that there is, in fact, a decrease in residual activity in the enzyme after heating if you have nothing else, if you have no folate in the extract. However, if you add folate to the extract, you stabilize the enzyme, both the wild type and the mutant, and you can reach high enough activity levels so that the enzyme can function normally. We saw the same thing with FAD, which is the cofactor of the enzyme, and that alluded to a potential role for riboflavin levels as well in terms of interacting with this mutation in terms of hyperhomocysteinemia. And that's, in fact, been demonstrated in a few studies now that riboflavin can actually decrease homocysteine in individuals with this mutation. And, in fact, it's been demonstrated in many, many studies now that folate can actually lower homocysteine levels in individuals with this mutation. So it provides a really very simple cure, shall we say, or prevention for individuals who have this mutation with respect to all the different disorders that folate has been associated with. So just to show you that it does, in fact, increase risk for neural tube defects, these are now data from meta-analyses, but we showed very soon after cloning the gene that this particular genotype was the first genetic risk factor for spina bifida. And what you see here is about a twofold increase in risk if for a woman to have a child with a neural tube defect if she's homozygous mutant. Same thing for the child, about a twofold increase in risk. Now, since then, it's become quite clear that there are a number of disorders by which low dietary folate or MTHFR can affect risk for disease, and I'm certainly not going to be able to talk about all of them. The neural tube defects and cardiovascular disease story is fairly solid. Pregnancy complications, neuropsychiatric disorders, Alzheimer's, depression, cognitive impairment, there's some controversial data there. Heart defects, I'm going to show you some data. But the interesting model actually has been neoplasia, in particularly colon cancer, because there seems to be a dual role for folate and for this particular gene in risk for cancer. And I'm going to show you some of the data from our mouse models that have illustrated this sort of dual role. So we did generate mice with a deficiency of MTHFR, and the little runts without fur are those with a complete knockout of the gene, and they're not that interesting for us these days because those would be more reminiscent of homocystinuria and more of a classic knockout. We really are very interested in the heterozygous mice, which are a single gene knockout because they represent the mild deficiency and risk for these various complex traits. So we really study these heterozygous mice. So, as I mentioned before, homocysteine is considered to be a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. There are clinical trials ongoing to lower homocysteine levels. And we were interested in seeing if there were some interesting or novel mechanisms by which MTHFR deficiency or hyperhomocysteinemia could influence risk for cardiovascular disease. And because we had these mice, we did some microarrays in liver, and I won't go through all the mouse stories. But the punchline was that we found that homocysteine could actually lower the synthesis of ApoA1, which is the primary lipoprotein in HDL cholesterol. So that may be one mechanism by which hyperhomocysteinemia contributes to vascular disease by lowering the synthesis of this protective form of cholesterol. And we went from mouse to humans. And we had some patients with cardiovascular disease that we received, samples that we received from Jacques Genet here at McGill, and we were able to show that there is, in fact, a negative correlation between plasma homocysteine and plasma APOA1 levels, showing that homocysteine probably reduces APOA1 synthesis, and there's some other relevant correlations that I won't go into. But then we tried to see if there was anything we could do to sort of manipulate the APOA1 levels, and we used betaine, which is considered to be an alternate methyl donor for the homocysteine remethylation pathway. So we fed these mice with betaine, and we looked at APOA1 staining in the liver. And in fact, you do see an increase in APOA1 staining in the liver because you've successfully lowered the levels of homocysteine with betaine. Betaine is actually used regularly to treat patients with homocystinuria. It hasn't really been used for mild hyperhomocystinemia, since folate or B12 have been the more traditional agents. But nonetheless, it is effective, and we were quite pleased to see the increase in APOA1 staining following betaine therapy. Now, coming to pregnancy complications or other types of birth defects, what we've done over the years is we've taken pregnant mice, and we've taken the two genotypes. We have wild-type genotypes and MTHFR-deficient mice. We put them on controlled diets. We put them on low folate diets. And then we look at the embryos. And what you can see here is that MTHFR deficiency, even on a controlled diet, increases the delay rate of these embryos. There are more delayed embryos under these conditions. And also the low dietary folate during pregnancy increases the delay rate. And, of course, if you delay the growth of the embryo, you put them at greater risk for a variety of birth defects based on actual hypotheses that Clark has contributed to, the threshold in terms of catching up, in terms of delay, and depending on the organ system that may or may not catch up, you may have a particular kind of defect. We did, in fact, look at congenital heart defects in these same studies, and we found an increase in congenital heart defects in mice that were MTHFR deficient in the pregnant mice, and we also saw an increase in mice that were fed low folate diets. So we believe that low folate and MTHFR deficiency are risk factors for congenital heart defects, which is probably the most common, which is the most common birth defect in humans, about 1 in 150. We also looked at APOA1 levels in the placenta of these mice in this complicated slide, but the punchline again is that we see decreased staining of APOA1 in the placenta of mice that are on low folate diets. And given the importance of HDL cholesterol for growth of the fetus, we believe that this could contribute to either the delay or to the birth defects in the offspring of mothers that are hyperhomocysteinemic due to MTHFR deficiency or low folate. The story with cancer is actually very interesting, and in fact, colorectal cancer has been the most significant cancer in which dietary folate appears to play a role. There have been many, many studies from the epidemiologic community, but we were interested in demonstrating this directly in an animal model. So we put our mice on low folate diets for a year, and then we looked at the intestine, and sure enough, we found increased numbers of intestinal adenomas in mice that had been on these low folate diets for a year. And this is actually the first time that a dietary deficiency alone has shown this propensity to form colorectal adenomas. Most of the time, the studies have been mice with germline mutations or mice treated with carcinogens to tease out these potential tumor-forming effects. So this is dietary folate deficiency alone. And we've looked at mechanisms, and we can show increased DNA damage due to folate deficiency, and there may be some methylation changes, and I won't go into that. But what I wanted to mention is the fact that folate may have a different role depending on when you add the folate. So, for example, we treat cancers routinely with antifolates. We use methotrexate, we use 5-fluorouracil to treat tumors, so therefore decreasing folate should have some sort of decreased rate of growth of the tumors, and yet I've been telling you that if you have low folate, you will probably increase tumors. So just to look at the opposite side of the story, we used min mice, which have an APC mutation. This is the same mutation that's mutated in hereditary colorectal cancer in humans. And we cross these APC mice with our MTHFR deficient mice. And these APC mice form about 30 to 50 adenomas, and you count these routinely, and then we cross the mice with, as I said, with our mutation and counted tumors. And what you see are various combinations of maternal genotype, offspring genotype, and dietary folate. And what I just want to highlight here, for example, is the protective effect of an MTHFR deficient tumor. You actually lower the number of tumors if the mother is MTHFR deficient. And if you compare each of these in the control dietary group to the folate deficient group, you also see a decreased amount of tumors if the mice are fed low folate diets. So what's going on here? And we think that, as I said, there's this dual role. If there are no tumors, if there is no tumor predisposing mutation, if there's nothing going on, then a low dietary folate can actually cause DNA damage and push the cell towards tumorigenesis. On the other hand, if you already have a tumor predisposing gene, such as APC or something else, or you've already got the tumors that are forming for all kinds of different reasons, then the low folate or the MTHFR deficiency may actually reduce tumor growth because folates interfere with DNA synthesis. We've also looked at other genetic variants in folate metabolism. MTRR is a gene that Roy cloned. And this is a mouse model for MTHFR deficiency, and we look for congenital heart defects because there is a common polymorphism for MTRR in human populations, even more frequent than the MTHFR one. And what we saw was increased congenital heart defects in mice, in offspring of mice with MTRR deficiency. So we think that that particular genotype in the population may also increase risk for congenital heart defects. And we've also studied another polymorphism more recently. This is the gene that Bob McKenzie cloned, the trifunctional enzyme. There is a common polymorphism in human populations. It's about 20% homozygosity, so also very common. And we've shown that this particular mutation also destabilizes the enzyme, very similarly to what I showed you for MTHFR. And in fact, the data here suggests that folate may stabilize this particular mutation as well. So this may, again, offer a very simple way of overcoming the effect of the mutation. And we've looked at children with heart defects for this particular polymorphism. And thus far, we do see an increased risk for congenital heart defects, conotruncal defects, and other types of defects in children with this particular genotype. And we're in the process of generating a mouse model for this particular deficiency as well. Now, given everything I've told you about MTHFR deficiency and the variety of potential deleterious effects, why is this mutation so common? Why is this polymorphism? Why does it persist in human populations? And, of course, for geneticists, the classic reason for maintaining a mutation in the population has been a selection, positive selection, possibly against various pathogens, host resistance to pathogens, hemoglobinopathies, and selective advantage against malaria and so on. So we decided to test this hypothesis, and we set up a collaboration with Sylvia Vidal in the Center for Host Resistance, and she used her cytomegalovirus model in this case because that's what she works with on a routine basis. I'm not suggesting that CMV was in fact the selective agent that has kept this mutation alive, but it's possible that there are other pathogens that may have contributed. And so what we did here was we used the three different genotypes in our animal model. And if you look in the spleen and you look at the number of viruses in spleen, there is a decreased amount of viruses in the mutant mice, suggesting increased resistance to at least this particular pathogen. And we've done this in mouse embryonic fibroblasts, the same, at least Sylvia has, the same decrease in viral infection in the mutants. And we've done the opposite now. We have mice that overexpress MTHFR, and so if you look at wild-type and transgenic mice, you do see a bit of a decrease in resistance, more viral particles, so the opposite effects in mice that overexpress the gene compared to those that underexpress the gene. Whoops. And, of course, Emil Scammony, who was also a member of our group, created the Center for Host Resistance, and we're now collaborating not only with Sylvia but with Philippe, trying to look at resistance against malaria. And unfortunately, I didn't have the opportunity to collaborate with Emil when he was a member of the group at the time. I guess I was too slow to come up with this hypothesis. But nonetheless, the center has been a very important entity at McGill and is now very useful for us, and we're delighted that it's there. And I just want to thank all the various members of our lab that have contributed to many of the studies that I showed you, and the collaborators at McGill and elsewhere that have been instrumental in helping us with our work. Thank you.